Well, Hosea, Hosea chapter 2, I really love Hosea. As you know from chapter 1, Hosea is representing God, and Gomer, this prostitute whom he's married, is representing Israel, God's people. Verse 1, say to your brothers, am I my people? And to your sisters, Ruhama, I will have mercy. Well, she had children, and he looks at them and says, this is not my people. This is not one of mine. And there she was crooning up to him, saying, oh, you know, hon, here's our new baby that I've born for you. And he knows that she's been out there sleeping with all manner of fellas, and that this is not his. He would have looked at the child and thought, no, this is not mine. And so he's asking the children to plead with their mother to try to get her to repent. And it's a bit like we are the children, because Paul quotes this about us in Romans, and he says that God has called those who are not his people, my people. And he says that applies to all those who are in Christ. And the idea is then that we are to plead somehow with the mother, that is Israel, to get her to go back to God. But the language you read here in Hosea 2 is pretty strong. Let her put away her prostitution, or else, verse 3, I will strip her naked and slay her. This is, of course, the judgment for adultery and for prostitution under the law of Moses. So he has these sort of conflicting feelings. He loves her, but then he hates her. He wants to judge her. And he says he's going to judge her. Verse 2, she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Contend, when he says contend with your mother, contend, this is a legal word. This is as if they're in a divorce court. And this, she is not my wife, neither am I her husband, is apparently a quotation from various divorce formulae which were used in Babylon. So he's saying that we're going to divorce. And then he talks about, and I'm going to kill you. Well, you can divorce and kill someone. Well, I suppose you could, but it seems, I suppose you could get the divorce through and then kill them straight away. But I think he's conflicted here. There were various options under the law of Moses for how to deal with adultery. You could put a woman through the trial of jealousy in Numbers 5. You could divorce her. You could kill her or have her killed. Or you could just forgive her. And Hosea seems to be toying with those options. One minute, divorce her. Next minute, nah, kill her. He is extremely broken down. And he is acting and speaking just as somebody would when they are in the trauma, the emotional trauma of being presented with a child and you realize, by your wife, and you realize, this isn't mine. And I know she's been sleeping around with everybody. And we're seeing here a picture, really, of God's conflicted feelings about his people. He threatens in verse 9 that he will take away her clothing, her wool and her flax that he has given her. And this refers, I think, to the duty of marriage, that a husband was supposed to provide food and clothing for his husband, for his wife. So again, he's going back then to the idea of not killing her, but divorcing her. And yet he then goes on in verse 2, let her put away her prostitution and her adulterers. He knows full well that this is what she's doing. Lest I strip her naked, verse 3, and make her bare as in the day that she was born, and make her like a wilderness. So the metaphors used to describe the anger of God with Israel are pretty awful. You know, he's going to kill her children with thirst in the desert. He's going to strip her naked. And when you come to Ezekiel 16 and Ezekiel 23, she's going to be gang-raped by her lovers. It's as if she's going to have her nose cut off and she's going to be left as a battered, bleeding mess in the scrubland. Jeremiah 13, she's going to have her skirt pulled up over her head and her nakedness revealed. She's going to be so ashamed, Ezekiel 23, that she will seek to pluck off her own breasts. This is all violent language. It's the language of rape, of extreme humiliation. And these images that you get are pretty much bordering on the pornographic. In Ezekiel 16, he talks about Israel as a woman having pubic hair, about her breasts, about her menstrual cycle, about gang rape, about her being mutilated. Ezekiel 23 talks about the size of the sexual organs of those whom she was in love with, her breasts, etc. And you almost sort of skip over that kind of stuff like you do when you read it with young children, sort of, we sort of won't read that, or let's read one of the Psalms instead, or whatever. You know what I'm saying? It is shocking. And of course, for early Israel, it would have been even more shocking because, you know, we are bombarded with this kind of pornography and stuff in the news, etc., in a way that I think they weren't. And yet the prophets are using the same tactics, as it were, that a lot of the media use with this kind of thing today. Shocking stuff to grab attention. And of course, all this outrageous sex talk really is to grab attention and to show that, look, if you make alliances, as Israel had done and Judah had done, with Syria and this one and the other and Egypt, to try to rescue you from judgment, if you don't trust completely in God, but you trust in your own strength and in human strength, this is what you are doing. It's as bad, it's as if this is what you're doing. And, you know, we sort of shy away from that and think, well, you know, I'm a good bloke, really. I mean, okay, there's a few whoopses. But, you know, this is what God is saying. This is what sin is. This is not a couple of whoopses. This is not, oh, well, yeah, I do trust in my job, in my career. Well, I do trust in whatever, my wife's income, my husband's income, whatever it might be. I do trust in that inheritance that I'm hoping for. Yeah, well, that's sort of being human. But all this kind of trust in anyone other than God is so shocking to him. And it's described here in very, very coarse and extreme language. So Hosea sort of outlines his plan here in Hosea chapter 2. It's sort of an insight into his own mind, although, as I say, he's very unstable in what he's thinking. He's going to get her away from her lovers. He's going to take away her food and clothing so she appreciates his generosity to her. And then if she still doesn't return, she's going to be exposed naked and shamed in front of her lovers, etc. But he never does this because he loves her. That's why you don't shame the person whom you love, even if they are unfaithful to you. And so when God says in Ezekiel 26 that he's going to judge Israel as women that break wedlock are judged, well, he did, and yet he didn't. All the time, Hosea is longing, fantasizing, if you like, for a time when she is going to be faithful to him. And later on in this chapter, I think you've got a picture of his fantasy where he fantasizes about an open-air wedding ceremony, but after all she's done, they actually enter into a covenant again and they get remarried. And that sort of thing is not unknown in our times when couples break up and then decide to get back together. They have a kind of a second wedding sort of thing, a recommitment. And I think that that is what God is fantasizing about. And he's saying that this is going to be an open-air wedding ceremony, and the sound of God saying, "I do," is going to echo backwards and forwards between heaven and earth. And the animals and the natural creation are going to join in this whole thing with joy. Now, that, as I say, was his fantasy. And loving somebody involves, in that sense, fantasy. Because it's to have fantasy, I don't mean in a perverted sense, to imagine, if you're more comfortable with that term, to imagine grossly, in a grossly exaggerated way, scenarios between you and the one whom you love, that is part of love. And Hosea had this for her, and this was God's fantasy, if you like, also for his people, that they would enter the new covenant with him. And yes, they would start again. They'd broken the old covenant, law of Moses. So Jeremiah and Ezekiel, he offers them a new covenant. And the tragedy was that they didn't really want that. They wanted to remain, for the most part, in exile, and those who did return didn't really accept the new covenant. But we have accepted it, and we take the cup of the New Testament, of the new covenant, to celebrate the fact that we have said yes. And when you look at God's tragic experience with women, if you like, or his tragic experience there with Israel, then it sort of dawns upon you that, wow, and he's taken me. Oh, and with all your heart, you pray to God that may I be your faithful woman. May I not be like Israel. May I be your faithful woman, weak and unattractive as I feel that I am to you. But all the same, you have set your love upon me, and I believe that. But please make me faithful. May I not be like her. And it's almost the tragedy of God's previous abusive relationship, really, with Israel, and how badly she treated him, that sort of almost makes you vow that I shall, in my weakness, at least try to do better. And so he talks in some length later on here about how he is going to take away her basic food and clothing that were from him. Because, he says, she has used those things and the gold and silver I gave her in her worship of idols and in going to her lovers. And then he says at one point, well, now let her lovers, let them provide for her her food and clothing. The fact that she rejected his food and clothing and took theirs was deeply upsetting to God, because there was the duty of the Hebrew husband to provide food and clothing for the husband, for the wife. And it sort of is like that with us. God has promised to provide us with basic food and clothing. I do believe that that is a promise that he's made. And whilst in extreme cases, for a period, in a temporary sort of way, let's say there's an earthquake or a volcano goes off underneath your feet, there may be a hiatus in that. But in the end, I do believe that God has promised to provide basic food and clothing, just as he did to Israel in their wilderness journey. Amazing as it was, but their feet were kept good in sandals that never wore out. Their clothing they took from Egypt never wore out. They were given bread and water every day. Of course, they wanted more. They talked about the garlics and the fish and the onions that there were in Egypt. And yeah, the point is, God has promised that to us. God has promised that. And when we distrust that and say, no, look, I'm taking a break from going to church, I'm taking a break from all this God stuff, because I really need to focus upon my career, and I really need to focus on my business because I'll need more money. Wait a minute. God has promised to give you the basics. And I understand we're all tempted in our age, particularly, to want more than the basics. God has promised that. And David said, I've never seen the seed of the righteous begging bread. And I can say that. I spent most of my life living amongst very poor people. But I can say that I have not seen any true believer genuinely long-term hungry or genuinely long-term without clothing. God will provide. And this is the whole thing of the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread, the bread for today, and he will come through for you. He will do this. But, of course, we want so much more. But to actually basically tell God, I'm not going to take it from you. I'm going to take it from someone else. I'm going to take it from my business, from my career, from maybe even joining another religion that offers more welfare money or whatever, so that I think that I will, you know, be better provided for. This is all throwing back in God's face his undertaking to us. It is his honor to provide those basic things, as it was for the Hebrew man, to provide those basic things for his wife. And the fact that Gomer didn't want what Hosea was providing and wanted to take them from her lovers, as I say, this is speaking directly to us. Because we must believe that God will not allow us to go hungry, literally hungry, I'm talking in literal terms, and he will not allow you to go without clothing. He has promised that. And as I say, I look around in my life, and I've not seen the seed of the righteous begging bread, and neither had David, King David. And so that is the promise. But to say, yeah, I don't know about that. I don't really want that promise. I want to get it from my idols. Well, you know, this is throwing back in God's face our relationship with him. So, I think this whole narrative also plays very much on the fear that there was in Hebrew men of the unfaithfulness of their wives. You see this in primitive societies to this day, that men in that sense don't fear women, but they fear their unfaithfulness. Because if your wife was unfaithful to you, let alone if she had kids by some other guy, really all that you stood for and your family stood for and that your house stood for was then in shame, it was disgraced. You were destroyed, actually, by her unfaithfulness, especially if she had a child by someone else. And that is why very often in primitive societies, the usual way is to kill the wife who does that, simply because of the huge shame and destruction and the great difficulty that it's going to create for the husband to carry on living with that woman in the understanding of society that they had. So God is using this and applying it to himself, that in a sense, God is at stake. God and all that he stands for is at stake if we are unfaithful to him. This is the urgency of the position. This is why God is not indifferent. This is why God is not simply busy elsewhere and occasionally looks in at us on this earth and says, oh, yeah, Duncan, well, how are you going? I'll have a chat with you at the Day of Judgment and we'll see how you made out, and I'll weigh it all up, I'll do my sums, I'll do the judgment, and I'll give you a yes or no, okay? No. I think that is the misapprehension that so many Christian people have lived under, and it's absolutely wrong. God is passionate about us. God really wants us in his kingdom. He loves us. He has set his love upon us. And therefore, for us to reject that, or for us to say yes to that and then to abuse it and to turn off to other idols, to other lovers, etc., God is at stake. All that God stands for, the essence of him, his whole purpose, the building of his house, his family, is at stake. And it's nothing less than that. And he views our behavior and our choices with a sense of urgency and with a huge interest and a huge concern lest we should be unfaithful. Well, in all this, you see that God is alive. God is really alive and is absolutely passionate to the point of having conflicted feelings. So passionate is he. And there is no reason to think that God was passionate about Israel back then, but, well, he sort of is a bit more relaxed and takes it all a bit more in his stride these days when we mess up. No, that is how it seems because of the apparent silence of God. Because you can sin or make great acts of love and commitment towards him. And cotton wool clouds still float across the sky, and there is no smiley face or sad face appears up in the sky. It just seems that, well, life went on and God didn't notice. He was someplace else. He does. He absolutely does. He has these feelings very intensely. Just as Joseph did when he was meeting his brothers, but he had to put on this mask as if he was not aware of them and was not feeling anything. It's shown in Ezekiel 24 when Ezekiel's wife dies and God says to him, don't show any emotion. I know you love her. She was the desire of your eyes. He recognizes that, but he tells Ezekiel, don't show anything. And you think, why? Well, because Ezekiel was God's representative, like Hosea was. All the prophets were. And the idea was that when the temple fell, God had feelings of hurt and distress and pain. He was distraught, but he didn't show them. That was what Ezekiel was to act out, and to show that when his wife died, the desire of his eyes, he did not go through publicly any mourning process. He was told to internalize it all and to simply show the same face at the day of her death as he had done before that. And so this is the thing, that the apparent silence of God can hide these very intense feelings that God has for us. Let's be aware of that, and let's respond with our whole heart to him and be his faithful woman.